So welcome everybody. I want to do something a little different today, and I feel a little bit like Spike Jones in the one-man band because I have a recorder and then an iPhone and a speaker to play something for the second half of what I'm going to do. So I want to do two pretty different things. They may have some relation to one another and they may not. The first one I hope will be really short, and the second one is just a piece of something else that'll take about 10 minutes. So I just wanted to wish everybody an auspicious Midwinter Day. And we talked last week about Midwinter Day, and here it is. And I wanted to say just a couple things about maybe Midwinter Day in relation to our practice. And it's not a real consideration of them. It's just a few reminders and then some outliers. The first thing is an outlier. It's just a quotation from a really beautiful poem by John Donne that Jeff probably knows and some of the rest of you may. It's called A Nocturnal Upon St. Lucy's Day, being the shortest day of the year, and it's about the death of somebody who is very dear to him, and it's written, you know, at least in the fiction, is it's written at midnight. And I'll just quote the last line because it's so great. It says, "For this, both the years and the day's deep midnight is." It's a really beautiful line, and so that's the midwinter moment, you know, midnight of Midwinter Day. And then I wanted to quote a few things that are much closer to home for us and that remind us that this kind of zero point of sinking down into darkness is really a crucial part of our practice. Some of the things I'll quote are literally about darkness, and some of them are about things that are related to that dark moment. So as those of you who have rakusu certainly know, every time we put on our rakusu, we say the prayer of the rakusu, and it goes like this. This is the robe of freedom, the bare field, the blessings. I receive the Tathagata's teaching, which wakes all beings. And so that bare field, as Joan says, is partly what's left when our opinions and views of things have disappeared. But it's also that bare field where, you know, it's stubble. Everything has died, at least for now, you know, everything visible, and it's that kind of 0 degree moment of winter, and that seems really important as well. We've spent a lot of time at various points talking about taking part in the gathering, the Shinto text that in American Soto Zen is known as, I'm going to blank on it, it's Sekito, and it's, anybody remember? I'm blanking on it. Oh, the Sandokai, that's right, the Sandokai. Anyway, so fairly early on in the Sandokai, we meet this. The darkness is inside the bright, but don't look only with the eyes of the dark. The brightness is inside the dark, but don't look only through the eyes of the bright. Bright and dark are a pair, like front foot and back foot walking. And a bit earlier in taking part in the gathering, we get this Taoist image. The mysterious source of the bright is clear and unstained. Branches of light stream from that dark. So there is that primordial darkness that's an important part of our practice to engage, and Midwinter Day is one of its moments. Joan talks a lot about the dark well at the center of the temple that we need to sit down next to, and that we can never see to the bottom of. And this is, you know, in terms of the calendar, this is that moment, though that well pervades other moments as well. The Heart Sutra, which we chant on a regular basis and which we'll be turning toward probably fairly soon again, this passage from the Heart Sutra has various other meanings and interpretations in terms of notions of emptiness, but for me also it has something to do with that dark moment that's also the moment of midwinter. Therefore, in emptiness there is no form, no sensation, perception, mental reaction, consciousness, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no color, sound, smell, taste, touch, object of thought, no seeing, and so on to no thinking. Which doesn't leave a lot of stuff out, you know, in some way. That's the moment where, in some way, there is nothing, and you sit with that nothing. If you're working on the koan no, or also mu, you might encounter in some of the commentaries pretty famous moments from Hakuin and also Linji. So Hakuin talks about working on that koan, and he says, while he sat with no, the whole universe was sheer darkness. And Linji says, it was like an ice cave a million miles thick. Just recently, we bumped into the Kalpa ending fire, which also doesn't leave a lot of stuff kicking around. And let me just read that since it's so short. A student asked Dashwi, "It's clear that the fire at the end of this kalpa will completely destroy the universe. I'm still not clear whether there's something that won't be destroyed," he asked, kind of hopefully, I think. Dashwi said, "It will be destroyed. It'll follow along with everything else. It will follow along with everything else," said Dashwi. So nothing left out of that moment, of that darkness. Everything goes into it. Of course, for us, if we're not dying yet and the kalpa hasn't ended, the midwinter moment, the moment of darkness, also turns towards something else. The koans again and again tell us when you get there, and they might talk about various theres in this respect, but that 0 degree of darkness is certainly one important there. When you get there, you need a place to turn around. There's a very beautiful ending to an experimental poem, a book-length poem by Bernadette Mayer called Midwinter Day. And at the end, as in a couple other places in the poem, even though it's sort of very hip and, you know, it says fuck all the time and things like that, the end gets really decorous and rhymes, and it sounds like something written much older. And I think that has something to do with an elemental pattern that's been going on for a long time that she evokes. So the very end of this 110-page experimental poem goes like this. "Welcome, sun, at last with thy softer light that takes the bite from winter weather and weaves the random cloth of life together and drives away the long black night." And for Hakuin too, the moment of the universe being sheer darkness isn't the end moment of the story either. This is quoting from an account offered by Shibayama, the Japanese teacher. And you've heard this before. In the biography of Master Hakuin, we read the following moving story of his first encounter with his teacher, Master Shoju. Shoju asked Hakuin, "Tell me, what is Joshu's mu?" What is Zhaozhou's note, we would say. Hakuin elatedly replied, "Pervading the universe, not a spot whatsoever to take hold of," which I think is that, you know, sheer darkness. As soon as he gave that answer, Shoju took hold of Hakuin's nose and gave it a twist. "I am quite at ease to take hold of it," said Shoju, laughing aloud. The next moment he released it and abused Hakuin. "You dead monk in a cave, are you self-satisfied with such no?" This completely put Hakuin out of countenance. And I think that, in a way, the point of that story is, if you spend the rest of your Zen practice and the rest of your life in the dark cave or in the ice cave, you've made a really big mistake. But it's really important to go there. It's really important to make yourself available to that place when it turns up in meditation or in other parts of your own practice. It's a crucial descent, or maybe renunciation, but I like the word relinquishing better. And in that moment, you let something you were holding on to very tight fall from your hands so that your hands are free to receive something else. So I recommend Midwinter Day and Midwinter Night and darkness to your practice. So we talk a lot about there's this thing going on in this room and there's something else going on in another room, and that's the way it is. So what I want to do is I want to play you some Beethoven, which lasts about 10 minutes, and we'll have a little time to talk after that. And it may have something to do with Midwinter Day, or it may not. It may have something to do with the ordinary mind koan, or it may not. That's really up to you, but I don't want to necessarily make a connection. I just want to say it's Midwinter Day, and we're going to listen to some Beethoven. So what I'd like you to do is just, who knows what'll happen, but just sit with it. You know, it's not really a koan. It's not a Dharma talk, but what happens? This is the third movement of Opus 110 from, it's a late piano sonata. And the pianist is Vladimir Feltzman. I hope this works. It's funny, on my iPhone, it says it's Beethoven, but it shows Bowling for Soup. But it really is Beethoven.
Thank you.
what that's about. That's really weird, I'm sorry. There's 15 seconds left, you know. The last 15 seconds is really nice. Well, okay. So you'll have to get it to find out how it ends. But what about that?
From my own personal history, that thinking about the, you know, the healing power of music, how it can shift things in you. And with our altar cloth disappearing, I brought in this tablecloth that actually my grandmother embroidered. Mm. And my grandmother is a very tortured soul, you know, and I think she's still needing a lot of healing, probably forever.
Mm.
And that, but they had, she didn't even have a like of music, but they had actually gone like to the symphony as an upward mobility business kind of thing. And I thought, well, whatever reason a person goes, just sitting there, it's like some of that healing power of music would be happening. So it's just interesting.
Thanks.
Yeah, I had a lot of that personal history stuff too. I kind of went in and out of it, like things would sort of come in and then I would just say, you know, let's see what happens if that falls away for a bit and just be with it. Or it just, maybe it fell by itself. But I grew up listening to classical music on and off, played live in the home, you know, that way, because my mom play the piano, so at first, and that's not, there are a few pieces that I hear that remind me very much of her. That was not one that she played, but she's dead, you know, and so at first that was kind of like a sadness. And my sister was a symphony musician for 24 years, and during this time that we were here together in town, I went to the symphony a lot. But it's not really my, you know, like I'm not, it's, there's the healing power of it, but I don't like go out of my way to listen to it, even though sort of throughout my family, I have other symphony musicians in my family too, but I don't listen to symphonic music that much. So, you know, just kind of, that's interesting. And then just taking it, you know, I did feel a little bit, solstice-ish, like there's some kind of a connection there.
Yeah.
So, that was me.
Yeah, thank you. It's interesting, when you take something nonverbal like this, it's going to have such different effects on different people, and people are going to engage it in such different ways. That's interesting.
That's something that I did notice. I never listened really truly to a complete piece of classical music, and always favored alternative and more contemporary music, but listening to this and without the judgment, without trying to think it's boring, whatever it is that I usually do, I found it really interesting. I thought a lot about there not being words.
Yeah.
There was a different impact on me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's up to the listener, for me anyway, I was thinking, to interpret it however we want. And what I really liked about it is it was almost like there's a foreground and a background. And the foreground is what I could interpret, or not interpret, listen to.
Uh-huh.
And I could hear the different tones, which I noticed songs with words that I like are the ones that have the words that are very sparse and far apart, and that's what I was noticing about this, that there were notes that were, and I found it very pleasant to listen to those notes.
Yeah, that's great. So somehow the background is there in some way too, that there's something behind that, which may have something to do with what some of what Jen was saying about the midwinter day part. You know, there's something very spacious kind of behind it or something. That's great,
Yeah, I was really in touch with the background. And I think part of it is that, probably sparked by our conversation last week, I've been, and partly because it's the time of year, you know, I've been finding myself in that, well, it's funny because I get that memory of being up in Taos on retreat a couple years ago, and we got there late. It was kind of fraught with complications, but for me it was a very deep and dark retreat. And for me, my practice has, there's been a lot of darkness in it that for me is very comforting. It's this deep peace and relaxation. I mean, literally, I had to keep myself from like puddling onto the floor because I just felt like I was melting into that background. And I've been intentionally having bits and pieces of that retreat come to me. So maybe things Joan would say, or actually having a physical sensation of sitting in the dark, literally in the darkness in the middle of the night, because I was up almost all night that last night in the hall. And I guess the other thing, all of the readings you did at the beginning were wonderful. And what's interesting is that I had independently chosen case 28 out of here, which is Taishan and when he blows out the candle, and they're in the darkness, and the student has an awakening, and so I've always loved that koan, and it just called to me this week, and so I picked it back up. And And it felt like it. My experience of that koan felt like the background.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So there's something really big and dark, kind of, and still kind of behind it. So that's what I've been thinking about it the last day or so. That sort of midwinter sense of stillness. The thing that people say about there's an image, I think it's actually Charles Olson writing on late Shakespeare, but Shakespeare's plays are really changeable. And so Olson has the image of like the language in the place is like a helicopter. It can like go any place and turn any direction and set down someplace else like really quickly and sort of surprisingly in a way that airplanes can't move. And that's sort of what people say about late Beethoven, that he's got this incredible ability to be one place and then just really quickly it's like, oh, someplace else, you know. So it's incredibly varied and kind of startling. And so I was thinking about it also in relation to the ordinary mind koan and what it feels like to sit. And my reaction sitting with it is I get no narrative at all. I just listen to the music, you know, and I feel like the music is very open to whatever is arising in that moment. There's a real open-hearted quality about it, and there's a real trust, you know, in that whatever different thing there is that comes, and it's often in the music, really different. I mean, not just sort of thematically or something, but emotionally, it's very tender sometimes. It feels very fierce sometimes, you know, and it's just available to that. And I feel like there are moments in retreat or other sits where I'm sitting with the content of my own thought in a similar way, that it's now it's one thing and now it's something really different. And I'm kind of mesmerized by it and my heart is open to it. And I mean, that's my experience of sitting here in the hall today again, you know, listening to that, just, oh, now it's this, now it's that. And so one of the reasons I brought it in is I thought that if anybody had a similar reaction of just being able to be there with it, that in a way it's like this is kind of an odd thing to do with it, I guess, but it's kind of a lesson about how to sit in some way, you know. It's like, oh, whatever's happening, you know, there it is, and you can attend to it with that warmth and compassion, really. So the last 17 seconds are really nice. I'm sorry, I don't know what happened, but you'll never know how it came out unless you buy the record, you know. So.
Well, it was mostly in my narrative, but it was that thing too, when it really came to that pounding place, where I was kind of startled, where it had been more tender before. It is some of that aspect of just like, okay, this is what here's what's here now.
So Soen Roshekas used to play Beethoven's Ninth Symphony at the end of retreats, and I don't know that much about Beethoven at all, but the people that I was taught by, the poets I worked with who were also classical violinists and stuff, if you like this at all, what they said is that what you want is like the late Beethoven sonatas, this is one of those, and especially the late Beethoven string quartets have this quality to them, and they're really just heartbreakingly beautiful sometimes. So another week I want to bring in something by the Rolling Stones, so we'll do that too. We'll save that for a while, but there's some stuff we could do with that too.
So you can bring in Monkey Man at the beginning of the piece.
Well, I always start singing to myself, I can't get no satisfaction through
that. So anything else before we close? All right, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for doing that. It's great.